From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine, Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The United States Congress passed a pandemic relief package worth almost $1 trillion U.S. dollars that will deliver long-sought assistance to individuals and businesses. The wide-ranging bill still fell short of the Democrats' demands for funding, and President-elect Biden is already signaling his intention to provide a third round of assistance in the early days of his administration. Over 40 countries have imposed travel bans on people arriving from Britain after the government announced last week that it had detected a new, more contagious strain of the coronavirus. A more contagious strain was also detected in South Africa. Meanwhile, the European Union gave official approval for the coronavirus vaccine developed by BioNTech and Pfizer, while the United States began distributing a second COVID-19 vaccine developed by U.S. drug maker Moderna. U.S. lawmakers, including President-elect Biden, Vice President Mike Pence, and the leadership in the House of Representatives and Senate have already received vaccinations. A massive hack of U.S. government agencies and private companies is being called unprecedented in its size and scope, with security experts pointing to Russia as the culprit. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Attorney General William Barr said Russia appears to be responsible, and leaders in both political parties called for a strong response from the White House. However, President Donald Trump disputed the severity of the breach and Russia as the responsible party. And in a tumultuous start to the final month of his administration, President Trump continued his attempts to undermine and reverse the results of the 2020 election, with Trump loyalists suggesting that he impose martial law to enforce new elections in swing states that he lost despite the Electoral College declaring Biden the winner. Finally, Trump announced his latest round of presidential pardons, which included two men convicted of lying to Special Prosecutor Robert S. Mueller and four government contractors convicted in connection with the killing of Iraqi citizens. Panelists, welcome. And it's just a completely packed show today, so we'll try to get right to it. I wanted to start with the COVID relief package. Congress passed a $900 billion pandemic relief package that will deliver long-sought cash to Americans. It's a massive document, some 5,600 pages, my sources say, is one of the largest, if not the largest, bill in writing that they've ever seen come through from the Congress. It has some essential items, such as direct payments and extended unemployment benefits. It also excludes some items that both parties had fought for. Molly, I'll start with you. What are the most critical items that are included, and what was left out that each side wanted?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, the biggest headline in this bill is the money for ordinary Americans to help take the edge off all of the disruptions and suffering that COVID has caused in the economy. So at first, the lawmakers were not talking about further direct payments. Instead, they were simply going to extend the enhanced unemployment insurance that was provided earlier in the year. But there was a sort of confluence of interesting political coalitions where some populist Republicans such as Josh Hawley and left-wing Democrats such as Bernie Sanders were together advocating for these direct payments to be part of the bill. And the White House also was said to have wanted that. There is an extension of that enhanced unemployment insurance, not the $600 per week that was in earlier packages, but about $300 per week. Some other provisions targeted toward COVID, money for things like vaccines and vaccine distribution, some more small business aid, forgivable loans to small businesses to help them stay afloat since so many have had to close. And then there's some stuff that's unrelated or tangentially related to COVID, as tends to happen in these big sort of Christmas tree bills that Congress passed. And this was all done as a package with the annual spending bill that also needed to be passed to keep the government open. As you mentioned, there were some things that both sides wanted and had to give up. For Republicans, it was the idea of liability protections for businesses, which was something that the Senate leader Mitch McConnell had called a red line earlier, but eventually gave up in negotiations. And for Democrats, it was aid to state and local governments whose revenues have seen a big hit from COVID at the same time as they are providing so many public services to help people get through it. But state and local governments will get funding in some other areas from other parts of the bill, such as funding for schools that is in this bill separately. So it's a big bill, not as big as some wanted, but it does represent a bipartisan compromise. And everything seemed fine until at the 11th hour, the president decided to cannonball into the pool and declare that he was not happy with this negotiation that he really had not been a significant part of.
Abdur-Rahim, Republicans and Democrats are blaming each other for a delay in this bill. I think very few people, if any, thought it would be this long before relief was distributed by Congress to the ordinary American during this pandemic. They're blaming each other. Are they both right? Are both sides to blame?
I think they are. It has to be said for people, obviously, who don't know how big of a deal Christmas is in the United States. Traditionally, Christmas is a big deal, even in normal times. But there's absolutely nothing normal about the times we're going through now with COVID-19 and possibly its mutant variant of it, and the kind of suffering that COVID-19 has imposed on Americans, both in terms of sickness, lives, economic difficulty. And you have members of Congress who've been bickering about this for months through the suffering of a lot of Americans, a lot of American families, a lot of American businesses. And I find it extraordinary that $600, the checks that Americans are supposed to receive, $600 could be a lot of money for a lot of families. But I still find it, you know, extraordinary that both parties have been bickering about this. And now, after they reached this bill, there's talk about, well, you know, the Republicans never told us that the president would be okay with $2,000 as the amount of the check, as the Democrats are now saying. $600 is a lot of money. $2,000 could be even a bigger help, obviously. But 2 days before Christmas, it's still not sure where the whole situation is headed. Will Americans receive $600 or $2,000 or nothing at all? We don't know at this point, with the president having taken the line that he's taken. We don't know if he's going to veto. We don't know if he vetoed, what complexity overriding the veto would involve. Both Republicans and Democrats passed this with comfortable majorities in both houses. But there's no guarantee that the comfort around overriding the veto would still be there if it came to it.
Molly, you mentioned the president weighing into these negotiations. He has been noticeably absent through the entire process. And now it seems as though he's putting out a fire with a can of gasoline here. So what does he hope to achieve by these proposals on this legislation, making the statement that the bill is a disgrace and the bill is outrageous and unsuitable? Does he really expect to get the changes that he's asking for? Or is this yet another political ploy to, in essence, drum up support for his desire to stay in office?
You know, it's always a risky proposition to try to discern Donald Trump's motivations. But it really does appear to be nothing deeper than a desire for attention. You know, as you said, the president has been disengaged with this process, not just this negotiation, but the entire process of COVID relief, you know, starting when the two parties in Congress started working on emergency legislation back in February. From time to time, he would wade into this debate with conflicting messages, sometimes saying he was for something, sometimes saying he was against it, sometimes urging the parties to come together and negotiate without at all specifying what he wanted to see in the bill, and then sometimes declaring, you know, that he was walking away from the table. So he hasn't at all been a constructive presence in these talks, and he's been pretty disengaged, particularly since the election, from anything having to do with COVID. So it is quite true that neither party had any idea. And the White House itself, and, you know, the president's negotiator on this bill was the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin. He did not know that the president was going to put out this statement or that the president was displeased with the place that the negotiators ended up. It was a very difficult negotiation, very polarized and partisan Congress. They were finally able to get to this point and get something that could pass both houses. And at that point, Trump seems to have realized that this was all done without him being a part of the negotiations. And he seems to have seized on some sort of misleading right-wing tweets having to do with the amount of foreign aid, not in the relief package, but in the overall spending bill, to declare that there was, you know, waste and bad spending in the bill at the same time as he's calling for more spending for the checks for Americans. So it will be a really interesting test now that Trump is on his way out of office. Do Republicans, are they still afraid of him in the same way? Will they still do his bidding simply because he says so, even when they clearly would like to go home and celebrate Christmas with their families instead.
Indeed. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Molly Ball, National Political Correspondent for Time Magazine. Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas. And our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. The COVID-19 update, it was a mixed bag of news regarding the pandemic as Germany, Belgium, France, and Canada were among the 40 countries that imposed travel bans on people arriving from Britain after the British government announced that last week it had detected a new, more contagious strain of the virus. The World Health Organization says that it's also studying variants of the coronavirus that was found in Britain and South Africa, adding that there is no evidence that they are deadlier or more severe than the more common strains. And again, the best thing that people can do is to work to suppress transmission through mask wearing, social distancing, and hand washing. I'll start with you, Abdulrahim. What are doctors saying about the new strains of the coronavirus? And does this discovery of the new strain represent a new threat and even a setback in the battle against the pandemic?
The doctors are saying, with the initial panic that came with the news that the variant was discovered in the UK and that many countries have basically stopped flying to and from the UK, there came a silver lining with specialists like Dr. Fauci saying that they do not necessarily believe that this could be a worse form of the virus than the COVID-19. I think us here in the United States, if one can talk of a silver lining, I don't know to what extent it is a silver lining, but to the extent that people were gearing up for Christmas and that Dr. Fauci, the administration of Donald Trump, the team of President-elect Joe Biden have all been calling for people to be extra cautious. All the talk about locking down some parts of the economy in various parts of the United States, I guess that has cushioned the panic that would otherwise have come with the news of this new variant of COVID-19 to the United States. So the country would have called for extra caution no matter what. The fact that the news has coincided with Christmas, I guess, is the silver lining, because at least psychologically, it helps contain the fear and the panic.
Molly, a famous novel begins, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." And that seems to be an apt description of what we get when pandemic news these days, when we see record numbers of positive cases being recorded, record numbers of deaths, hospitals being strained to the limit. And at the same time, we see, again, a second vaccine being approved and being distributed within the United States. I want to ask you sort of about the politics of the distribution of the vaccine. We see that the CDC recommends that first responders, more vulnerable populations are vaccinated first. But we also see at the same time, President-elect Biden, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, Senate Leader McConnell, and other electeds jump to the head of the line to be vaccinated. We also see coronavirus deniers like Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham getting early vaccinations. What's the importance of the opticals of this? Is it reasonable and correct for our elected officials to jump to the head of the line? And is there a backlash against those getting vaccinated who have been deniers and in some cases spreaders of the virus itself?
I don't know that any of those, I would call those politicians deniers. I mean, they certainly acknowledge the existence and severity of the coronavirus, even if they may have disagreed with aspects of, you know, the experts' recommendations for the response. But look, there is, as you know, there's an obvious tension here, because on the one hand, the supply of the vaccine is limited and governments have to decide how to prioritize different populations as they get those limited doses out to the public. On the other hand, there's a lot of skepticism of vaccines, both the vaccines in general from this, you know, anti-scientific, anti-vaccination movement that has spread so vastly in the United States in recent years and has done so much damage. And also this specific vaccine, I think there's skepticism around, partly because there's been so much disinformation and misinformation around from COVID overall, and partly because the Trump administration in the United States and other governments around the world have not necessarily inspired great public trust with the way that they have both handled the COVID-19 response and put out information about it. So these elected officials, as they presented, they're not trying to get something that other people can't have in order to sort of hog it for themselves. They're trying to demonstrate to people that this is safe. They're trying to provide assurances to Americans who may be worried about whether it's okay to get this vaccine, that this is something they should trust and it is something they should want to do. So they're trying to set a good example and say, if your turn comes up on the list, please do get the vaccine, because everybody who's eligible needs to get it as soon as possible in order for society to be able to further reopen and return to normal.
And health professionals have also said that even with getting a vaccine, people should maintain social distancing and also engage in mask wearing. So we'll see if those politicians who have taken the vaccine will also follow up on points 2 and 3 and be consistent and send positive messages in that way. Let's move on to the U.S. hacking issue, a massive hack of U.S. systems that raised alarms across the government and the private sector. This from an NBC News report. U.S. officials are deeply concerned about a massive and ongoing cyber attack targeting large companies and U.S. agencies, including the Treasury and Commerce Department. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency called the attack a grave risk to national security. Secretary Pompeo and William Barr have said Russia appears to be responsible. Russia, of course, denies any involvement, and President Trump seems to be of a completely different mind about what happened and who done it. Abdur-Rahim, what do we know about who was affected? And there is a general consensus that Russia is responsible for this, am I right?
There is. Members of Congress, many of them agree that it was Russia. Lots of private companies involved do believe that it was Russia. Mike Pompeo said in an interview that he believed it was Russia behind the cyber attack. Although in the same interview, it has to be said, he did say that he thinks China is an existential threat to the United States. But obviously, President Trump captured the headlines. He captured everybody's attention when he said that it's not Russia. It may be China who is behind the attack. That obviously has raised a lot of old questions, the old skeletons about why is the president always trying to, as his critics say, defend Russia. So there's a quasi consensus that it was Russia in Washington, that it was Russia behind the attack. But we don't know that for sure. There were members of Congress who even went so far as to say that what happened was a declaration of war. But we heard from Joe Biden, the president-elect, he didn't go so far as to call it a declaration of war. We've seen some catchy editorials in like the one in the Washington Post by David Ignatius saying also that he doesn't think that it was a declaration of war. It was part of espionage that usually goes on in the world, except that this is a massive scale. And I found it interesting that he compared the United States in terms of the internet to what Lebanon or Belgium are as small countries where basically other peoples fight their battles. Now, David Ignatius says that the United States is the internet territory, so to speak, where a lot of international powers are now fighting their battles. Obviously, what happens in the United States doesn't stay in the United States. I mean, the United States has a lot of cyber relations with a lot of its allies around the world, and many of its allies use software and infrastructure basically made in the U.S. and shared with them by the U.S. So there's a lot of concern around the world as well.
Indeed. Molly, some are calling this a hack, while others, like Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, are calling it an attack. And I believe he used the description of the attack being akin to Pearl Harbor. An attack demands a response. And my question to you is that response likely to come from the Trump administration during these last days of that administration, or is that response going to have to wait for the incoming Biden administration?
I think it's clear that it's going to fall to the next administration to straighten out the very tangled morass of Russia policy in the United States. And it's going to be a really interesting area to see how President-elect Biden decides to handle Russia. You know, back when Biden was vice president under President Obama, a lot of Republicans were critical of the administration for not being harder on Russia and not dealing more forcefully with Vladimir Putin. Fast forward to the Trump administration, that's not a very common Republican criticism because, as Abdul-Rahim was saying, the president has been so reluctant to criticize Russia and Putin in particular for reasons that appear, again, to be personal sort of ego-related motivations on Trump's part, having to do with his sensitivities over the Russian interference in the 2016 election, which every American intelligence agency has corroborated, and the only person in the government who appears not to believe it is the president. As you said, it does matter how we look at these kinds of maneuvers. It is both an attack, it's a cyber attack, and it is a hack. That's the way these things are done. But because the president appears so invested in wishing away these kinds of attacks, it's clear that the next administration is going to have to take on both the logistical response in terms of how to protect the American government from these kinds of attacks, figure out how the attackers were able to penetrate these systems and try to shore them up, and then the diplomatic response, whatever types of sanctions or other potential responses the new administration is going to try to levy on Russia in retaliation for this. And it's going to be a very delicate and difficult area of American foreign policy that's going to be, I think, on the front burner of the many, many diplomatic crises that the next president faces.
I want to finish with sort of get some broad thoughts from you. You had meetings in the White House discuss imposing martial law, something we've never seen in a modern White House. We have the White House considering installing fringe elements as special counsels to investigate the election that was called by professionals the safest and most secure in American history. And then there was a slew of pardons that include a veritable rogues gallery of cronies, corrupt politicians, and war criminals. Molly, let's start with this martial law idea. Michael Flynn, who was former national security advisor, now a convicted perjurer, convicted and pardoned, I should say, by President Trump, and others were in the White House asking the president to declare martial law. This from reports. How far in your reporting has the discussion gone? Is it still being considered?
Yes and no. I mean, it's an idea that the president likes because it's being dangled in front of him by these basically irresponsible charlatans who want him to believe that he continue to stay in power when that is absolutely not the case. These types of anti-democratic maneuvers are really a threat to our democratic system, and they're being enabled by these sort of fringe elements. As you mentioned, you know, even people like Attorney General Bill Barr, who have shown themselves willing to do the president's bidding in a lot of ways that trouble outside observers, even they have sought to get as far away from these kinds of suggestions as possible. And you hear a lot of alarm from the people who are still left in the administration at the lengths to which the president appears willing to take this. I don't think there's any chance that any of this actually happens, but just the fact that the president is indulging, you know, the insane conspiracy theories like those being promulgated by the attorney Sidney Powell. It just can't be emphasized enough that the things that they're saying about problems with the election aren't true. They are feeding the president lies, and he is eagerly lapping them up because he wants to believe that there's some chance that he can somehow overturn the legitimate result of this free and fair election.
Abdul-Rahim, I want to finish with you on the point that Molly just made.
Quickly, let me say, it seems to me that whatever he does now, whatever he says, is not going to change the outcome that Joe Biden will become the next president of the United States. But like Molly said, although they're not likely to pan out in anything practical for him or for the rest of the United States, these are very significant developments, whether in the specific context of U.S. democracy or in the specific, in the general context of what the U.S. means to the rest of the world. There are obviously jokes around places like the Middle East that, you know, President Trump has been so buddy-buddy with dictators and military regimes in some parts of the world like the Middle East that he's becoming a bird of a feather. People following this, whether you're talking about the issue of declaring martial law or politicizing the amnesty for the people that he's amnestied now, as I said, dictators and military regimes around the world, they just gone to town over. They basically basically saying, look, if the United States of America can do this, we can do it too.
There's so much more to talk about on all of these topics, but unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to our panelists, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.